Accession number 27185, reel 63.
Major Barras, reel 63. You were saying about the band.
Yes, I was later when I heard that bands had been stopped or dissolved in no longer on the establishments of battalions. I was devastated because I've always reckoned, all right, the colours may be the soul of the regiment, but the band is the heart of it. Taking a band away, there's a loss of something. When I had adjutants' parades, I always had the band and drums on parade, unless there was something particular I wanted to do which didn't include marching. And the days when they were marching perhaps without a band and the days when they were marching with a band was entirely different. It made so much difference. And I don't know, I mean, when I was across in Normandy last month for the unveiling of the 2nd Essex Memorial there, the Normandy band came over from the Queen's Division, and I thought they were excellent, and they made a total difference to the complete difference to the whole ceremony. If they hadn't have been there, it'd have been a sort of very drear sort of performance, I think. Anyway, I became, as I'm just sort of passing, I reached the age of 37 in August during that trip. I didn't get a cake, I have to say. Not that I was expecting one. The first stop we had was Zanzibar. Now, that was still a British protectorate. So I remember the waking up and going out on deck when we first arrived off Zanzibar and sailing down the side of the coast. It was a cool, nice cool morning, balmy but cool. And I looked across and I could see a long strand of white sand backed by thick palm trees, blue sky, turquoise sea, and a waft of spices coming off the island, particularly cloves. It was quite an enchanting moment as I stood there on my own up there. So later we docked and we went ashore. I think we took a taxi and went round the Sultan's Palace. Well, we weren't allowed in it, but we went around the Sultan's Palace there. Christopher came with us, but Tim stayed behind, I remember, with a nurse. But of course, the Sultan wasn't to last very long. They got their independence, I think, in 1962, and then the Sultan was later deposed, and Zanzibar became part of Tanganyika, which then became Tanzania, didn't it? That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was very interesting. But when we went ashore there, there was a lot of unrest later.
I believe. Ask if there was a political atmosphere.
Yes, but when we went ashore there, there was nothing at all. It was totally peaceful. Of course, it had been the centre of slave trade for centuries before we ever thought about doing it.
Population was mixed, I think.
It was mixed, yes. Yeah.
Of course, some trouble later.
That's right. Well, of course, the Sultan was an Arab, and I think the bosses, so to speak, were Arabic. But a lot of the population came from the mainland, of course, Africans. But of course, when we went there originally, in 18 something, I think there was nothing there at all, really, very much. It was just used as a trading station for slaves. And we had built it up and brought in all the spices, which made it solvent, almost solvent. I don't know whether it continued to be.
It was the island of cloves, wasn't it?
Yes, cloves, that's right, yes. But they had other spices there as well, but it was the cloves that I could smell wafted off the land. Well, as we steamed south, we got cooler and went into the... we were now going into the South African winter, so... We were out of our jungle green and into battle dress. And our next port of call was Cape Town. Probably, well, it must have been the first British troop ship to call. Don't forget, it's now 1956. the Mediterranean was opened, they all had to go around there. So they were used to it in those days. So we caused quite a stir amongst the sort of British element, or the British element, because the Transvaal, not Transvaal, what do they call the Cape Province?
Cape Province, yes.
That's right. Was basically British settled. So that they're still there, their descendants. So they all turned out in thousands. And we got word from somebody who said that they all wanted to take troops ashore, and take parties ashore. So this was all organised, and they all went off with various people. And we were lucky enough, Anne and I decided we would like to go. So we had a retired headmaster and his wife, who very kindly took us in hand. And they took us ashore in their car, and they drove us all round the back and through the vineyards and beautiful countryside. They took us somewhere where we had lunch. We took Christopher with us again, I think. And not that he would remember any of it. And then they dropped us off at the ship again. I'm not sure whether we didn't go out with them a second day or not. I can't remember. Anyway, they continued for several years after that, every Christmas, to send us a box of grapes. And then eventually dried up. But they were a very lovely couple. The hospitality there was incredible.
I think that was something they did frequently during the war.
Yes.
Troop convoy turned up, they tried to entertain the troops.
That's right.
2 days before they went on.
But they were really falling over each other to try and get some troops or somebody to go with them. I'm just trying to think anything else happened there very much. I know this couple wanted, because the business of apartheid was beginning to rear its head there then when we were there. And I remember writing up a little bit of a screed, a memorandum, and sending it round to everybody saying, don't get involved in politics when you're ashore. Because it was just beginning to sort of simmer up. And whereas the white population were keeping, well, the British element were certainly keeping clear of getting themselves involved at this stage, the Dutch element were starting to impose there, because they were now in the government and were starting to impose some of their ideas of apartheid, which, of course, was very unpopular. So we steer clear of that.
Do you happen to know if there were any Dutch who did any entertaining, any Afrikaners? Who
I don't know. I doubt it.
Or if they were all English?
No, I doubt it. I don't think so. There may have been. I don't know. I don't think it's the sort of thing that they would rush down to do. I suppose they'd been Dutch troops that had been there, but I don't know. So after that, we began sailing north again on the other side. And as we rounded the Africa on the west side, we called in at Dakar, which was the capital and main port of Senegal. That was still under French control at that time, I think. And of course, we were now back into jungle green again, because we were now tropical, yes, and hot. We went ashore here. I remember going down into the town. It was a beautiful town, actually. It was tree-lined streets. And the people seemed quite happy and adjusted. I don't think we didn't have any problems there at all. Not that we had any problems anywhere we went, really. Anyway, we were there only one day. I suppose we must have again stopped to pick up fuel. Because I don't think these ships were originally, when they were designed, to go these distances. I mean, there were sort of local things where everybody was supposed to be put aboard and have a jolly good time sailing around the Baltic. But this was a bit different. So Eventually we sailed north again, and it wasn't long before we were back in battle dress, having taken out, of course, we were getting into the European summer, which is not as hot. It was some time, I think, during the voyage, I think latterly in the voyage, that Paul Comenti Smith's told me that a posting order had come through for me as QM11 in the War Office.
What's QM11? What does that mean?
Well, that was the planning arm,
yes,
of the Q Movement's directorate. So when I got there, I was to find out my job, which was global war. We eventually finished up in Southampton, where we disembarked. Well, with the merger coming up, I think a few went to wherever the battalion was going to be based for a short time. Of course, an advance party would have been sent ahead, which I should have perhaps mentioned earlier. Sam Pepys, as he insists upon calling himself, sorry about that, I wish he called himself Peeps. Sam Pepys is the second in command. Would have gone off with an advance party, which would have consisted of representatives from each company, each platoon in the support company, representatives from the quartermaster's department, and so forth. He would then go ahead wherever the battalion was going to be, and then make plans for the their accommodation and where everybody was to go, so that when the battalion arrived, eventually, they had the guides there for the companies, and everybody could be taken to where they were going. Everything could be explained to the quartermaster and anybody else where their stuff was going. In this particular instance, I don't think it worked out like that, because we all went off on embarkation leave, most of us, and a lot of us never returned.
You didn't go back to the battalion?
I never went back to the battalion.
Were you happy about going off to the War Office?
Yes, I was, actually. I was a bit dubious about going after my experiences with the Q movements in Germany. I was a bit dubious about going back to it in the War Office, but it was an entirely different situation. I didn't mind, because it would give me a period in the UK with a young family.
Stability
for a bit, because I'd been abroad now for most of the time since I went over to D-Day. Most of the time I'd been abroad then. So I was glad to be home, see my own family, and go and spend some time with them. So after the embarkation, I must have gone up to Hingham, I suppose, and picked up my car, which I put up on bricks in the stables there. Where Hingham, of course, was where my parents were. They lived in this great big Georgian house, which I think I'd explained before, leaving half the top of it absolutely empty, because I got the furniture to go anywhere to do it. and then my memory is that we're in a boarding house in Richmond. Why we went to Richmond, I haven't the faintest idea. But after that...
Did you make that measure yourself, or had that been made for you?
No, we made that ourselves.
You did.
Pretty sure about that.
Yeah.
I can't remember whether I could claim for it or not. I was on leave at this time, don't forget. So
yes.
Where I went on leave was my affair, I suppose. But I know we spent quite a long time up in Hingham with my family, because Anne's family was still in Jamaica at this time. So eventually we got a hiring, what was called a hiring, which was a list of houses which the War Office had, which the owners were prepared to hire out. Well, they were empty. Prepared to hire out through the War Office two individuals who the War Office thought should have a house to live in, because they were commuting to London or working elsewhere in the London district. So the first one we had was semi-detached, two up, two down in Carshalton Beaches, which was, because there was not many on the list at that time, was temporary. Happily it was temporary. so we moved ourselves in there, and then I started to commute to London by train from Carshalton Beaches to Charing Cross. Now, QM11 at that time had been moved into Northumberland House in Northumberland Avenue.
Yes.
During the war, when expansion took place. In fact, I found that bits of the War Office, as it was then, were scattered around all over the place. The paymaster, for instance, lived on the top floor near Piccadilly Circus for some reason or other. The Adjutant General was in Berkeley Square. So we were all scattered all over the place. Next door we had the JIC, I think it was called.
Joint Intelligence Committee.
That's right, in the Metropole Hotel. So we were in the Northumberland Hotel and they were in the Metropole. Not that there was any, of course they weren't runners' hotels, we'd taken the whole thing over. so eventually, just to finish off the higher accommodation point of view, we moved into a bigger house in Chipstead, which was an attached, nice house, big enough for us to live in, with a nice manageable garden, where I could commute from, what was the name of it? Did I write it down here? Chipstead. I used to go from Chipstead Station, that's right. The owner was an RAF Air Commodore, I think, who was still stationed in the country somewhere. And they'd left behind a little television set, which we'd never seen before. It was the size of a small box with a big bulbous magnifying glass in front to make the picture look bigger. There was only one station at that time, which was BBC, although ITV had started, but you couldn't catch it on this set. So it was available between 4 in the afternoon, I think, and 10 in the evening. And it didn't matter what was on. When I was home, and anybody was home, we'd sit and look at this thing, goggle at it with admiration, and wait right to the very end when it went black, you know, and the picture went dark, and this little white bit of light sort of slowly disappeared in the back, and then we sort of pulled ourselves away from it. We soon became discerning after a bit there, as we are now. And we've always been very careful with our children, that we did not allow them to look at television when they wanted. We always designated the programs they could look at. And I'm happy to see that they're now doing it with their own children, so that's one thing we've handed down to them.
Were you working regular office hours?
Yes. Yes, I used to commute. I used to go up by train in the morning and come back in the evening from Charing Cross. The movement, perhaps I should describe the directorate. The movements directorate was on the top floor of Northumberland House. It had a movements director of movements, who was a major general, Eubank from the Royal Engineers. I think if you call him a pleasant, clever, quietly spoken man, polite, with a nice sense of humour. He's just the chap for the job, because it was an inter-service job. He was chairman of various committees, which included the other services and some other ministries, like the Ministry of Transport and Civil Aviation, we used to get involved with. Under him was a brigadier. I didn't have much dealings with him, but I remember he was from Armoured Corps, I remember. I don't know what his regiment was. And I remember walking down the corridor with him once and him saying, in exasperation, "I don't think I'll ever be able to make a decision again," he said, because that was working at that level. Lieutenant colonels and colonels were to a penny. Brigadiers were everywhere. Even major generals weren't a sort of endangered species exactly. So everything had to be done on a sort of mass basis, went up to chiefs of staff if it was a big thing. If it wasn't, then perhaps local decisions could be made. But mostly the stuff was circulated and committed and put up.
It was executing policy rather than making it.
Yes, it was. It was policy, but it was churned. It was in the making. It was like in all the ingredients, so to speak, came from the directorates underneath. Mm. And when it was all put together into a pudding, then it went to the chiefs of staff. They made their decision about it, and they may send it back and say, look, we're not satisfied with this, we want a bit more. But they would have got their directions from the Defence Committee, which was
a cabinet committee
chaired by the Prime Minister, mm. with the Minister of Defence on it, and then one or two other foreign minister and so forth. So he was the brigadier. Then my lieutenant colonel was from the Leicesters. His Christian name was Brindley. Can't remember his surname. He wasn't there for very long. But the organisation of QM11 was—he was AQMG, Lieutenant Colonel. There were two majors, another one, and myself. The other one was responsible for short-term planning. As I explained before, QM11 was the planning arm of the movement's directorate. And I, personally, was responsible for global war, the intention of which, the object of which, was the reinforcement of overseas stations in a period of mounting tension.
Transitional period.
Which was 7 days, I think. Mm. They expected to know that in seven days' time there was a possibility that the Russians at that point, or the Soviets or the Eastern Bloc would launch an offensive.
Did the scope of your responsibilities include Europe, or was it those stations beyond Europe?
It included as far as the Middle East.
Yes.
But anything further than that, of course, couldn't be reinforced within 7 days, really. So I had Europe, yes.
You had Europe, so you'd be responsible for planning movement to reinforce British Army of the Rhine.
That's right.
And then there'd be our troops in the Mediterranean,
yes.
Presumably based on Cyprus by this stage.
Yes.
And then beyond that you'd have Aden, British forces.
Yes.
South Arabia.
Right.
East Africa, did you have responsibilities there?
Don't think so. I don't think we were concerned about East Africa at that time. I think it was more the sort of on the
mainland of Europe.
On the mainland of Europe and behind. Mm. I don't think we were concerned about Africa at that stage.
What about the northern flank of the European front, in other words, Scandinavia, North Norway, areas like that?
I don't think we had. I don't know whether we had troops in there at that time. I'm sure, yes, we did. Yes, we had them. We had them in Norway.
I think we had plans for reinforcement in, not of our own troops necessarily, but of Allied troops in Norway and Denmark.
Yes, I'm beginning to believe that we had troops up there. I don't know. We did later, I know. They weren't always permanent, though, were they? A lot of them went up there, as you were saying,
the Royal Marines go there
and train.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think they were permanent, but there obviously was a plan to reinforce them with our own troops, should there be an emergency.
When you started at this work, did you find a set of plans in being that you had to...
Well, they'd been started. They were very sketchy at that time. I took over from a bloke called Tasker Evans, who of the Bedfords.
Yes.
And he was just about to leave anyway in the army. And he'd been... All of us were Staff College graduates in this particular department. So I took over from him. It was a bit sketchy at that time. And of course the plan itself was enormous. Really, I had nobody working for me. I just had to flog through it myself, and it involved not only people but vehicles and tanks, armored vehicles. And it was a question of getting people had to be called up. A lot of the people who were going over, they had to be called up, reinforcement, people on the reserve, especially people like doctors, technicians and so forth. They were called up to their various centres. Then they had to be got to airports or seaports, according to where they were going. The transport and tanks also had to be mobilised and put on flats, as they were called. I remember the railways weren't able to provide enough flats, or probably wouldn't be able to. So I had to get a civilian's companies involved. Pickford's, I remember, had good flat vehicles which would take... I'm not sure they'd take the heaviest tanks that we had. I can't remember which the heaviest tanks were. The Chieftain, probably, was it, or Challenger?
Probably Centurion at that time.
Centurion, yes. That was getting pretty heavy, wasn't it? So I can't remember. Certainly get them on the railway. So I had to learn all about capacities of railways, how much you could put on the roads, what you could do at docks, in the way of craneage, shipping. So I went round a number of ports, Felixstowe, Dover, I remember, when I was taken round by the harbour master there and shown everything and given information about capacitors and capabilities. And then I had to draw up a list of overseas destinations with all their runway capacities, which I got from, obviously, from the Air Ministry. Shipping, alongside depths of water, fathoms, how many fathoms, what shipping they could take, and so forth. There was also connections with the Baltic Exchange concerning shipping.
Was this taking up ships from trade?
Chartering ships.
Chartering ships.
Yeah. But it didn't concern... A lot of it was done through other ministries.
Yes. So you were really liaising?
I was really the middle bit. Mm. It was trying to pull it all together.
Like the spider in the centre of the
world. Yeah, that's right. Mm.
Did you do most of this work by telephone or by face-to-face?
Oh, I prefer face-to-face when I could. Mm. If I wanted a bit of information, I'd telephone. But I got to know people in the Air Ministry, in the Admiralty, and in the Ministry of Transport and Civil Aviation in particular.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether I ever came in contact with people from the Foreign Office. I may have wanted some information from them, if there was a particular chair, as they call them, that I wanted to contact. So this went on for 2 years, actually.
When you were actually drawing up the plans, mm. were you simultaneously drawing up draft orders?
No.
You weren't.
It was a policy document.
Policy document.
Yeah. No.
So you were deciding which ports should be used for embarkation, which
yes.
routes the ports for
that's
the formations
right.
concerned.
Yeah.
And then presumably which airports
yes.
would be provided.
Yes. It was all a question of volume, really,
yes.
more than anything else.
Volume and speed, presumably.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. And then at the end of it, well, we're rushing it a bit now, but at the end of it, it was put up through the usual channels. It went to the planning committee, and then it went up to chiefs of staff. And I didn't stay long enough to know what happened to it, but they would have then issued, either amended it, or sent it back to the planning committee. I never got it back, so I assume that what they accepted what I
said.
So I accepted what they said. What I'd sent up was acceptable. But they would then issue it as a policy document with action to be taken by various people. And then all this action would have been then put together, and then a complete plan would have been issued, top secret plan by the chiefs of staff, which would have then been issued.